evening, everyone.
Right here, too.
We're opening the, we're beginning the meeting of the Joint Committee to Implement Measure 91 for tonight, June 8th, 2015. And tonight we're going to have the opportunity to hear some pretty interesting information. I'm going to open a public hearing and work session, just a work session. And that's going to give us an opportunity to hear about three bills that were posted on OLIS today and one or more amendments that were, two amendments to 3400, a separate bill, and actually possibly an additional amendment to 3400. All those elements are posted on OLIS and reflect some really focused, good work that people in the room, a lot of you in the audience, and people on the committee have been undertaking together to hopefully make progress on an outcome that reasonably meets the needs of a wide range of people. So with that, I'm going to open the work session on House Bill 3400 and also 2541. Is that the... Or are we just doing 3400?
Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee, there's a meeting material for House Bill 2041-2 that specifically deals with some taxation issues that, for several reasons that I believe Mark Mayer will be discussing shortly, why it had to be taken out of 3400. While that bill was not publicly noticed and is not on our agenda today, since it is germane to the issues, it's placed under meeting materials on OLIS.
It's really interesting stuff, and you'll be pleased to hear about it, so you can ask questions if you like during public information or public question opportunity. Co-Chair Burdick, would you like to make any comments at this point in the meeting?
No, just to say that we are reaching a conclusion on this, and I'm very encouraged by the progress we've made, and I'm hoping that we will be able to wrap this up in a timely manner.
That's right. All right, good. All right. Plus, also, you may have seen that if we go into next week for meetings, those meetings will be earlier in the day, which is a very nice thing. All right, then. So we've opened the public hearing. I'd like to begin by inviting Mr. Mark Mayer, who is our legislative counsel, to come forward, and if you could, sir, please walk us through the -9 amendment and the -10 amendment to 3400, and then also there is a -11 to 3400 that I'd love to have you quickly speak through as well.
Is that, Madam Co-Chair, the -11, is that now posted?
I think so.
Yes.
15
minutes.
Yes.
There. Do you want my laptop,
this
sir?
Drafting error. This is in the. This is.
Okay, I'll look at it later. No, I didn't know there's 11.
So you handed it down.
Chair Burdick, Chair Leininger, Mark Mayer, Deputy Legislative Counsel. I'm here to testify quickly about the major changes to the draft copy that was last looked at last week by this committee. I'm only going to address major changes as well as some of the other material that's in this amendment, as well as the -10s and the material that the -10s were pulled from. 3400-9. The first major change that I want to draw people's attention to, just for the sake of being as transparent as possible, is on page 84 of the amendment, sections 117 and 118. These sections used to be populated with water usage and the energy plan sections. We've replaced those with a cannabis education program section. This is basically telling the authority, Oregon Health Authority, State Board of Education, Alcohol and Drug Policy Commission, when developing the program that they already run through ORS 336-222 for educational purposes, to basically emphasize for the time being marijuana education.
Yeah.
I also want to draw attention to section 118, where they will report to the 2016 legislature on recommendations related to Among other things, use of monies collected as a tax from businesses involved in marijuana operations, and whether or not some of those monies should be funneled into this education program for educational purposes. So there's going to be a study, and there's going to be legislative recommendations through these two sections, as well as an actual education program itself that emphasizes this particular subject. And it will be an emphasis in an existing program. So hopefully that'll be something that can be more easily implemented. Second major change, on page 97, the section that was originally about early sales by existing medical marijuana dispensaries to adults has been removed from this draft. I've been told that that might be pursued in a different draft. We have replaced that with two task forces. The first task force is going to study energy usage, water usage, and other agricultural-related issues with regard to cannabis. The second task force is going to be a local option task force, and that task force is going to study basically the local option issue, whether that is something that should be handled legislatively in the future. If you have questions about that, I can certainly answer them, but basically those are the two those are the two points of interest of those two task forces. Third major change, page 161, directs the Oregon Liquor Control Commission to make an annual biennial report to the Legislative Assembly about the approximate amount of marijuana produced by persons who hold a production license and the approximate amount of marijuana items sold by persons who hold a retail sale license, and whether or not the supply of marijuana is commensurate with demand. It's a very simple direction for them to prepare this report in order to keep the Legislative Assembly apprised of the issue and whether or not perhaps that should direct future legislative action. Then finally, I want to backtrack to probably the more important component of this draft that has changed. I wanted to address it last because it ties into the Dash 10 amendments. That is on page 41 of the draft, section 34A. And I'll go over this one a little bit more in more detail because it's a little bit more substantive. This is a local option tax section. It disallows counties or cities from imposing a tax unless as expressly authorized by this section of law. And then it spells out exactly how a tax may be imposed by the governing body of a city or county. Governing body of a city or county may adopt an ordinance to be referred to the electors of the city or county that imposes a tax or fee on the sale of marijuana items that are sold in the area subject to the jurisdiction of the city or county by a person that holds a license under Section 22, Chapter 1, Oregon Laws 2015. And for counties, the unincorporated area subject to the jurisdiction of the county. That way there won't be a double tax. If the governing body of the city or county adopts an ordinance under the section, the governing body shall refer the measure of the ordinance to the electors of the city or county for approval at the next statewide general election. And then finally, a cap on the tax at 3%. So may not adopt or impose a tax or fee in excess of 3%. They can go under, but that's the cap at which the ordinance can take effect. Those are the major changes to the last draft of the Dash 9s, and this is an official published copy from our office. So we'll either have to do amendments to this amendment if there are future changes, or we'll have to reproduce another full draft.
Senator Przanski.
Mark, if we can just follow up on the last section on the local option tax. I understand that they can impose this, but does it have to go to the voters and be approved before the tax can actually be enacted?
Yes. The way it's written, correct. That is correct. It must be referred to the electors first. Okay. Do you want me to move on to the Dash 10s then?
Sure. There may be questions after this, or would you?
Yeah, before you leave that point. So what that means is a local government that is considering a tax if they decide to do it early in the election cycle, it will be some period of time before they can actually enact the tax, because it would have to go to the voters. Just wondering if that will slow them down in terms of citing. I guess it's just something to throw out there for the committee, whether it would slow them down from wanting to cite dispensaries if they had to wait for that election.
Senator Prudnosky?
Yeah. Madam Co-Chair, regarding the dispensaries, I think you mean retailers?
Retailers.
I just want to make sure we're got on the same page.
I'm talking about the recreational side.
Okay. And then the other part on that is that since the 91 actually said that there could not be any local tax, I'm assuming the reason that we're requiring it to go to the voters is to give them that opportunity to believe, because Measure 91, as it was passed, prohibited local taxation. So by giving that authorization to go to the voters, I mean, it makes sense to me that you would have the voters in that jurisdiction decide whether or not they do, in fact, want to have that tax imposed locally.
I think
and it seems like in the true favor of what the 91 would have contemplated if it was going to be issued on cross.
We might want to consider, Madam Chair, if I could
please
follow up, we might want to consider allowing, I know a big part of the purpose of the general election is to avoid additional costs, since all localities have to have it on the general election. But if we could maybe give some flexibility on when the election is held and let the local government decide when they want to do that. That might be a way to just get it going faster, because we're looking at 2 years potentially.
So that's good input. And I think the rationale behind having it at the general election is that under Measure 91, the vote on potentially opting out is also in a general election. So as Senator Prudnosky noted, the idea is to try to enlist the members of the community that may be affected in deciding whether or not that's an appropriate step, and to do it at the same time they might be thinking about other marijuana issues. But you raise an important point, so we can think about that.
Okay.
Any other comments? All right. So how about, Mr. Mayor, you move on to the dash 10s, and we can circle back. If people have questions about the entirety of it, feel free to ask those as we move forward.
So the other part that has been posted on OLIS is the dash 10 amendments. These are prepared as a separate amendment, even though they're both very large amendments. If the committee chooses to adopt them both, we will prepare a combined amendment in our office that will basically take the two amendments and put them together. The Dash 10 amendments, the language was taken from Senate Bill 964, with the exception of a few provisions. The provisions to note that are absent from this particular amendment are, first, the strong preemption language that was in Section 32 of Senate Bill 964 that very specifically states that a local government cannot prohibit the establishment of a dispensary in its jurisdiction. That language is removed from this draft amendment. Secondly, the local opt-out language that was toward the back end of Senate Bill 964, I believe it started at Section 67 and went through Section 72. That language has also been removed from this particular amendment draft. Otherwise, the amendment is largely the same. There are a few things that our office picked up that we fixed. Something that Senator Prudnosky mentioned at the last hearing about making sure that the definition of mature marijuana plant would be fixed and that it would align with the definition of mature marijuana plant in Measure 91, for instance, things like that. Took an opportunity to do some of that type of tweaking here, but substantively, these are exactly the same as Senate Bill 964. There are a couple other small tweaks that I could address as well if you wanted me to address those.
Are they substantive? I think probably none of us have had a chance to close.
No, they were, for instance, the issue about whether or not a school that reopens after it closes came up after 964 was adopted by the committee. We handled that in the Measure 91 language, and so I just made the grandfathering language in here match what we did in this other draft. The ability of a school that, excuse me, the ability of a dispensary that has been kicked out of the system because of the 1,000-feet rule. We had in a previous amendment written some language that would allow them to re-register quickly, and we put that into this amendment as well. But very, you know, that's pretty much the changes that we have done here.
Okay.
So just trying to make it match what we've done in this other draft insofar as those issues have come up during the Measure 91 drafting.
Okay. Any questions on that specifically? No. All right. So please continue.
And then finally, if you have a chance to look at the dash 11s, our office identified this as a drafting error in the dash 9s. A lot of stakeholder involvement in these particular sections, and we created a bad reference in the draft, and so it was, the issue was drawn to our attention. We identified it, and we went ahead and procured the dash 11s as an amendment to the amendment to fix the incorrect reference that we had drafted in the dash 9s. So obviously a draft this size, there's going to be probably some other errors. Hopefully we'll be able to pick those up and fix them in future sessions, and hopefully there's not too many that absolutely need to be handled currently. But
so if you'd like to, I don't see any questions at this point, if you'd like to go forward and talk about House Bill 2041, that'll complete the package of thinking that we've been undertaking, and that might spur people to be ready to ask questions.
House Bill 2041-2 amendments, which are posted as work session material, I guess. It's a complete draft as well, and this is the tax provisions removed from House Bill 3400-9s. We basically removed those provisions. We put them into a new bill because there was a desire to put an emergency clause on the 3400-9 amendments. The test for whether or not a bill for raising revenue is different than a tax bill. All tax bills have to have a 91st day upon passage effective date at a minimum. So that was the reason we pulled it out, is because there's a desire to do an E clause on this other bill package. So 3400-9 now has an E clause instead of a 91st day effective clause. The dash 2 amendments to 2441 still have the appropriate effective date.
And to jump in, the reason that it matters, the reason why there is an emergency clause on the 3400 is in order to empower the state agencies to begin rulemaking right away, because, for example, OLCC is charged with completing rulemaking to implement Measure 91 by January 1st. We need to have them not have to wait 90 days to start. So that's applying to 3400, but you can't apply an emergency clause to a tax bill. So we had to separate that out.
Yep. Any other questions?
Do you want to describe 2041-2, just so that people who don't have it in front of them or folks on the committee who haven't had a chance to read it can know what it entails?
Again, it's moving the sale from what is commonly referred to as a tonnage tax, or a tax on the weight of the product, leaves and bud, to a tax at the point of sale. So it moves that tax to the point of sale. If you look at the percent of sales that will be taxed, it is set at 17% for all products in this particular draft. And that number, of course, is subject to being changed if the committee chooses to do so. So currently the tax is set at 17% straight tax for all items. If a county or city chooses to impose the maximum 3% tax, that'd be a total of 20%. The language, again, is largely the same. It's that template language that allows the Department of Revenue to collect and administer the provisions of the Act with regard to collection of the tax. It allows the Department of Revenue to use their general powers underneath ORS Chapter 316 in order to ensure that the collection will take place. Those powers include the power to impose liens, issue warrants, et cetera, et cetera. And again, the template has been designed by our office in order to help create these types of taxes, and it's a much easier process than trying to reinvent the wheel in a lot of cases. There is language in here that allows the Department of Revenue and the Oregon Liquor Control Commission to enter into an agreement for any purposes related to the administration and enforcement of these sections. That's something that they can enter into via a memorandum of understanding between the two agencies. However, the legislation is directed toward the Department of Revenue as being the primary agency responsible for collection and enforcement.
Okay. Does anyone have any comments or questions on what you've heard?
Madam Chair, just on the tax thing, there's been some discussion on having different levels of taxation for different types of products. We, in recognition that we might want to move in that direction based on some experience, we have left those categories in rather than just set a flat-out tax rate. So the anticipation is if our experience shows us that a differential tax rate is necessary, it will be easy to fit it into this framework.
That makes sense. Yes, Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Somebody refresh my memory now. Do we get by with a simple 31 on anything related to taxes here?
If I could answer that, Madam
Chair.
Yes, please.
Sure.
If the revenue impact of this bill turns out to be equal to or less than the revenue impact of Measure 91, then it would be a simple, most likely would not require a three-fifths vote. But if there's any question about whether the revenue estimate might exceed that brought in by Measure 91, then it would clearly require a three-fifths vote. Did I say that right, Mr.
That is correct, Chair Burdick.
So for people who are listening, our intention in moving the tax from the point of harvest to the point of sale is not to change the quantity of tax leveled by that, but rather to change the point of paying for it, because we heard sort of resoundingly from people in the community that everyone thinks it would be better to have it happen at point of sale. So in an effort to be responsive to the feedback we've gotten and just have something administratively easy, we have, under the leadership of Co-Chair Burdick, who's done a great job of this, worked out a system to have it be applied at point of sale. And our intention is to have it be the same amount as would have been applied before. That said, it's kind of tricky to make this all really clear, because in Measure 91 there are different amounts for each thing, and so to the translation process is inexact, and so that's why, you know, it could be that we end up calling for a three-fifths vote, even if it's essentially the same level of tax, just to be on the safe side so that we don't end up on the wrong side of procedures. But our intention is to honor what is written in Measure 91.
And Madam Chair, if I could also add another point. Clearly the medical marijuana card holders are not expected to pay tax in medical dispensaries or in co-located dispensaries where they're buying medical products. I think it'll be a matter of discussion for this committee. We've had discussions in the past about whether medical card holders would pay at the retail end of things, but it is very clear that they will not pay when they're buying medical products, either from a medical-only facility or from the medical part of a co-located facility, and that is not specifically referenced here, but when the committee decides how we want to parse that out, that will be made clear.
Any comments on this? Any thoughts? So Senator Brzozinski, and then were you getting in line there, Senator Fairley? Okay.
So it's my understanding we're going to continue to work as to, once we have the OLCC system up, whether or not we're going to allow for what we would consider medical cells there as compared to keeping it potentially closed to the dispensaries only for medical purposes. Not that you wouldn't have medical product available for recreational buyers to buy, but potentially giving the benefit for a medical card holder to be able to purchase at either location, depending on what we decide as to whether or not medical cells will be recognized at a recreational site.
So thank you for that question. Mr. Mayor, maybe you'd like to speak to that. I think that there is an opt-in element in the dash nines, right? Does that go to the point that Senator Prudlansky was raising?
Chair Leininger, it does not. The opt-in is for medical marijuana growers to opt into the production system for Measure 91, where they would be able to sell their product into the Measure 91 rec system if they chose to basically allow OLCC to track their product and to regulate them as a licensee, and if they also segregated their crop, if you will, into both the medical and the recreational product. So it would be separate, so it could be easily tracked on the rec side.
But may I follow up? Would that not, though, enable a medical patient to come into a rec store and buy medical product from the rec store, or are we silent on that at this point?
We're silent on that. I think that there's nothing that prevents a rec store from carrying a medical product at this time in either draft. The way that these bills are set up is it does not contemplate a dispensary registered with the Oregon Health Authority being duly licensed. So they're two different facilities. But I don't think that there's anything that specifically prohibits, legislatively at least, a rec store from carrying what would be considered a medical product.
And then the question would be what the experience of a medical patient is who walks in and what their tax treatment is. Is that what you were observing, Senator Prudlansky?
It would be, and I think the other question that we've thrown to the table is whether or not we are going to limit the potion of the medicine, what's available on the rec market. In other words, potency. Yeah, thank you. And the potency issues as to what would be available at a retail operation, since if you had something that was 95% THC, would that be available at the rec store for anyone to purchase, or would that be exclusively allowed only to be sold through the dispensaries?
Mm-hmm. Am I right that the OLCC's power in rulemaking to establish rules around potency covers that, or is it silent on that at this point?
No, that there are. In the labeling, packaging, and dosage sections, there are powers for OHA where it's appropriate for OHA to do the rulemaking, and for OLCC where OLCC is in charge of the rulemaking to distinguish between medical and recreational products. They have that ability by rulemaking.
Thank you. So we have Senator Farioli and then Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The only caveat I would offer is don't confuse people about the requirement for a constitutional vote on the question. Build it into the discussions. Assume that you're going to ask House and Senate members to make a constitutional vote on the tax issue.
Three-fifths majority.
Yes, and then you don't have ambiguity about the issue. You are creating a mechanism. Because if for any reason the expedient is less than a constitutional vote, you'll get, that's the first stop on the way to litigation.
Right.
Because as soon as you get more money than you've anticipated, somebody will say the tax rate's higher than we were told in 91, you know, we'll see in court.
Okay.
And they might prevail. So
I think that's fair and good advice. I think, Senator Burdick, you've sort of echoed the same thing in an abundance of caution, because it's a fairly untested, you know, it's a case of first impression situation. We may go for the three-fifths majority to avoid a situation where we accidentally should have and didn't.
Chair Leininger, Chair Burdick, that's our office's recommendation anyways. Whenever you're doing a tax bill, even if the bill is not considered to be a bill for raising revenue, it is safer to place it into a House bill and to attempt to get the supermajority vote so that it is not a question of whether the processes were followed correctly, and that can be put to bed right away.
Just
so,
the, Madam Chair, if it quacks like a duck, quacks like a duck and walks like a duck, it's a duck. This is a tax vote.
Okay.
Let people know.
Okay. Thank you for that. Senator Beyer.
Well, I'm having a little trouble distinguishing between, particularly if you're in a store that's selling both medical products and recreational products, how you distinguish between the two. When somebody comes in and wants to buy a joint, kind of looks the same on both sides, and if one's taxed and one isn't, and I'm a recreational buyer, I'm going to buy the cheaper one. How do we deal with that?
If you have a card.
Do you have to have a card? Is that how you're going to determine the taxes or not?
Yeah, you have to have a card not to pay the tax, for sure. The question, the policy question that I've heard a variety of opinions over the last couple months is, the policy question is, should a medical card holder, should their tax-free status extend only to medical products, or should it also extend to recreational products? And that's a subject.
And I guess my point is, I'm not sure how you distinguish between them. Could be, unless you're talking about the same product wrapped differently.
No, potency is one area.
Well, you may want something stronger.
True.
Senator Przanski, you had a follow-up comment, or did you want to speak to that first, Mr. Mayor?
The bill, again, it does, in the dash nines with the labeling section, Senator Beyer, it does allow OHA to create labels that are different for different types of products, depending on what market they're intended to serve. If they're going into the medical market, they'd have one label. If they're going to the rec market, they'd have another. So I think that ability is in rulemaking.
But what's to keep a recreational buyer from buying a medical product? I guess nothing.
Well, if they could buy the medical product, but they would have to pay the tax.
No.
You're just saying it's just a sales tax.
So, Senator Farioli, and then I want to make a comment.
Madam Chair, it gives me great comfort to know that the Oregon Health Authority and the Oregon Liquor Control Commission will be writing their rules for this, because even though the potency of the products and the dosage amounts are at issue, if people want to accumulate more THC in the bloodstream, they'll simply use more product.
Mm-hmm.
So the dosage issue might be something for us to worry about for packaging and disclosure for safety and purity. But in terms of the individual user, if folks want to have a different experience, they'll simply buy more of the product and consume more of the product. The end result, it's how much is in the system, the bloodstream and the tissues, not how much is in the feedstock.
Okay. I am a little uncertain at this point about whether, have we answered the question in this draft about whether medical products and adult use products will both exist in M91 stores, or is that something that's left to OLCC's determination and rulemaking, whether medical products to be purchased by medical buyers will be co-located with M91 stores?
Chair Leininger, none of the drafts touch specifically on the products themselves, with exception to the labeling and the dosage and the packaging of those products. The way that they are drafted right now, of course, if it's going into a dispensary system, since only a card holder, a patient, can go into a dispensary system, then obviously those are all going to be for card holders and patients, those products. There's nothing that really prohibits other products that are labeled as having a medical use from going into an OLCC rec store in these drafts, although the drafts also don't contemplate any special exemption from the tax itself at this point. So within the 2041-2s, as well as the dash nines. If these did not pass and there was still a tonnage tax, then all that product would still have the tax on it if it went into the stores. So at this time, it's really about the tax and where the burden of the tax, who has the burden of paying the tax. And in these drafts right now, it's anybody who goes into a rec store has to pay the tax,
okay,
whether they have a card or not.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Pruzanski. Senator Beyer, did you also have your hand up?
He's first.
Okay, Senator Pruzanski.
So, I mean, that's kind of what we talked about before, is if, for simplicity, if you say a cardholder can go into the dispensary and purchase their products there, everyone knows, one, they're a cardholder, two, whatever products are available in there is going to be there for them. What one of the things I'd been advocating for and what I thought we had talked about is that there's nothing to stop, as Marcus said, something that has medical attributes to it in the way of a product to go into a recreational cell. But if you're going to use the convenience of going to a rec store and as a patient instead of going to the dispensary, mm-hmm. then that's kind of like going to the local convenience store as compared to maybe going to where you normally would conduct your business. And I think the other part was that if we were going to want to have some type of regulation on the potency in the rec, you would just say, it'd come out in rule, let's just say for purposes of discussion, 60% THC or less is available in a recreational store, where anything above 60% would be only available in the medical side. And that way you could have these bright lines and parts.
That makes sense. And so I feel like what, based on the comment you just provided, we haven't answered every single configuration of every single question, but we've left it at an appropriate spot, and there's some work to do in rulemaking. Yeah. Thank you. Senator Beyer.
Well, it seems like we're involved in a whole lot of fiction about products. I'm saying if we just focused on the labeling requirements and the distinction being who has to pay tax and who doesn't have to pay tax, and just said if you've got a medical card, you don't have to pay tax regardless of where you buy it. And if you don't, you pay the tax and then let the consumer deal with it.
Mm-hmm.
Marijuana is marijuana.
So I think where we left it, where we've got it right now, if you buy from a medical dispensary, you are per se a medical patient and you don't have to pay tax. And as the draft currently is, if you buy from a rec store, you pay tax. So there is a bright line.
But what if you're a recreational user and you go into a dispensary and want to buy a product?
I think you can't.
You can't do it?
You can't go to the dispensary.
That's crazy.
Okay. One second.
That's a whole lot of fiction that doesn't make sense.
Well, thank you for that input. Anybody? Anybody over here?
You're doing great, Madam Chair.
Thank you, sir. All right. Would you like to, is there anything else you feel like you'd like to speak to? And folks, if anyone else has questions. Otherwise, well, thank you for your great work. You've worked extremely hard over the last 3 months, but in particular over the last probably 72 hours, 4 months, pardon me, nine months. It's been a really long time. It just feels like 4 years. Thank you, Mr. Mayor. And at this point, we're going to move to a presentation by Representative Buckley and his staff, or his staff, on some issues they've been working hard on this session related to environmental impacts from our transition to this wonderful legal industry.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I'd like to invite my staff up to do the presentation, and I'd just like to maybe introduce it by, if you remember many weeks back, colleagues, we did get a presentation on energy use. I believe it was the folks from Colorado were talking about the amount of energy used. And I want to make it very, very clear, I'm not trying in any way to impact indoor grows. I'm simply trying to make sure that people understand what the consequences are of indoor grows in terms of energy use and the concerns over water use for both indoor and outdoor grows, and to try to make sure that we at least have in place a process to come up with the best practices that will address our environmental needs and our energy needs that we've identified for the state. So with that, I appreciate your time and consideration. I'll turn it over to my staff.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Madam Co-Chairs, members of the committee, my name is Andre Phelps. I currently am a legal intern for Representative Buckley. Prior to that, I have a master's degree in environmental science and engineering, and I worked as an environmental consultant for a handful of years. Mary Beth Williams is here with me. Her and I worked on this presentation, and afterwards, if there are any specific questions you have, then we can both answer them for you. February 23rd, if you all recall, there was a presentation on energy electricity use here by Mr. McCarthy of PG&E and Ms. Sand here of Public Utility Commission of Oregon. Among other things, they both came here to speak to you about the anticipated electricity requirements that will be associated with indoor greenhouse growing of marijuana. Ms. Sand here stated that that Oregon has two choices in this matter. Either we build new power plants or we look at energy conservation. And Mr. McCarthy, his presentation had that slide that many of us remember, that showing that to grow four plants, it takes the equivalent of the energy use for 29 refrigerators. He also stated that from his perspective, that this this anticipated load is a really good load for PG&E. And not long after these presentations, our office actually was contacted by several constituents of Representative Buckley. The city administrator of Ashland actually had spoken to the city council and mentioned that he was really worried about the extreme electricity consumption by indoor marijuana grows, and that from his perspective, it had the potential to bump the city's rate up into Tier 2, the BPA Tier 2 category, which would actually increase the rates for all of Ashland. We began researching this issue, talking with people in Oregon, in Washington and Colorado, as well as some researchers. And in addition to just the electricity issue, of course, other environmental issues started to pop up that people were trying to get the word out about: greenhouse gas emissions and water use and pesticide use. Today, we are mostly going to talk about numbers. Really, that's when you get into electricity and energy, that's where you end up. We'll be as brief as we can, and water and pesticide we'll just briefly touch on at the end. Simply put, the numbers are staggering, really. These numbers are staggering no matter what the source. I went on media, conservative media, liberal, industry. No matter what source I looked at, no one was really disputing these numbers. Maybe the exact numbers are a little bit fluid because really the data is new and a little bit spotty, but the scale of the issues are pretty much agreed upon. So, should we just dig into the numbers? Okay. So, a lot of this, can everyone hear me? I hope. Mm-hmm. Yes. So, much of this information is readable, and I don't know if we need to go through all of it, but really, in essence, the typical grow facility uses a 1,000-watt grow light, which produces 130,000 lumens. And that's a grow light that is not a more energy-efficient light. That's a high-intensity bulb. Really, they use these lights because it tends to achieve the best results to get the highest THC. They use these for 12 to 20 hours per day, depending on the grow cycle. And as you can see, that 1,000-watt grow light uses an average of 16 kilowatts per day.
Thirsty buggers.
On average, a typical 10,000-square-foot grow site will use a minimum of 400 grow lights. And it's not just the lights, actually. The lights only really account for about 30-some percent of the total energy use. There's also HVAC, ventilation, humidity control, water pumps, all kinds of things. And those are both in indoor grows and greenhouse grows. So for some examples, the electricity needed to grow a 100-square-foot indoor grow would power six houses for a year. A grow site that is actually a little bit smaller than this room would actually equate to the electricity use of 60 homes. For a scale, 5,000-square-foot facility that we have talked as one of the caps would be equivalent of powering 300 houses per year. And finally, just to show the point, a 10,000-square-foot facility would equal about 600 houses energy for 600 houses. And these are not, in Colorado, there's a facility, 100,000 square foot facility. In Washington, there is a 120,000 square foot greenhouse that's being built. So these are small compared to those types of facilities. So we just kind of did a hypothetical. Let's say there are 37,000 medical marijuana growers in Oregon. If 100 of them were to shift into a 10,000 square foot indoor operation, then the Oregon would actually have, for the capacity, electricity capacity added to the grid would be 657 megawatts, which is the equivalent of 60,000 new homes, or building a 150 megawatt power plant, which is the size of one of the larger current hydroelectric plants that we have today. Of course, associated with energy, electricity use are carbon emissions, and these are of interest, of course, because of the renewable portfolio standard. Similarly, about 33% of the carbon footprint of indoor-grown marijuana is due to lighting, and the rest is to other equipment, and then there are some other more minimal things that add up to the rest of that. 1 pound of cannabis grown indoors equates to about 3,000 pounds of carbon dioxide. As you can see, we can show these numbers up to 10,000 pounds of cannabis equals 30 million pounds of CO2. That's the annual use of 2,870 cars. And if you want to compare this to growing 1 pound of tomatoes indoors, that comes out to about 16 pounds of carbon dioxide emissions. So the numbers, and many of us think of tomatoes as being energy intensive, but equates. Okay. What's happening in other states, generally they're having to deal with these issues in piecemeal regulations. And as I mentioned earlier, there's this issue of what happens to all ratepayers in a municipality when they are kicked up or jumped up into a different tiered energy rate. For some examples of what's happened in Washington and Colorado and California, the city of Arcata is a great example of the city saw that their energy rates were skyrocketing. They have a policy about greenhouse gas emission goals. So they levied a tax rate of 45% on homes that exceeded six times that baseline level electricity. What happened then is that within a year, 90% of those houses that originally were in that category, they were no longer there. What happened is that they all moved out into the county. Now the county is in the process of proposing a similar tax that will be on their ballot, their next ballot. Boulder County has also passed a tax. Other municipalities have decided to go the route of requiring renewable energy. Boulder County, by 2016, right now, they actually require 50% of all the energy used in indoor grow operations to be purchased from renewable resources. By 2016, that will be 100%. Another option we have heard about, Washington, Colorado, they're just starting to implement some of these rebate programs. The rebate programs they're just beginning, but the difficulty with that, of course, is that you already have these facilities that are up and working, and then you're asking people to get rid of their lights, to change out their HVAC systems, to try and be more energy efficient. And as was mentioned in the February 23rd meeting, these rebates are not available to everyone across Oregon. Anyone who is in a BPA or a consumer-owned utility territory will not have these apply or be available to them. And finally, as I promised, a quick primer on water and pesticides. Estimated water use for a marijuana plant is 16 upwards of 15 gallons per day, or 6 upwards of 15 gallons per day. And pesticide use is another big issue that many of the states have had to deal with. Unfortunately, it is considered illegal because the federal labels do not allow it to be used on cannabis. And Again, this is a piecemeal. In Washington, they are allowing a specific list of pesticides. Colorado does not have a regulation on it. So the takeaway is really just the extreme energy use that is required to grow a marijuana plant. And as was stated by PG&E, February 23rd, we really have two options. We can conserve energy or build new power plants. And although PG&E might welcome this load, I wonder how Oregon feels about welcoming this load and the carbon emissions that are associated with it. Which one are we going to choose? Thank you.
All right, thank you. Did you want to add specific comments?
This is Mary Beth Williams, Representative Buckley's legislative assistant. I'm just here to answer questions.
Great, thank you. Any follow-up questions for the panel? Senator Beyer.
Well, I guess part of your thing there was about the moving consumer-owned utilities onto Tier 2. I would suggest that that's not actually the case necessarily. Mm-hmm. Under existing law, the consumer-owned utilities can set differential rates, and in fact, they can set a higher rate for these kinds of industries if they choose to. That's their decision whether they would want to do it or not. So I'm not sure that that's exactly the same. The other issue I kind of wonder about is these are the same types of load statistics that you'd find for a server farm, and I wonder why we would treat these any differently than we would treat the server farms, which most communities salivate over.
Madam Chair, Senator Beyer, I can maybe answer the first one, and Mary Beth can answer the second one. From what I understand, and I am not an expert in energy, Ashland's issue is that they have energy use out to that's formulated out to 2020 that did not include any additional energy sources, so that is where the possibility will come for being bumped up into Tier 2 now past 2020, or maybe in those two-year contractual increments that they have, then they can adjust for that. But currently, that is.
I think you're correct on that. Yeah. They're a high-level mark now, but I believe that they have the authority, if they choose to, mm-hmm. to say to a user like this or anybody else, we'll give you power. They have an obligation to give them power, but you're going to pay market rate for it. And they would then go out and acquire it on the market like any other utility.
Madam Chair, Senator Beyer, about the second issue, it is actually very much like a data farm, data centers. I think some of the differences is we don't require licensing specifically to open a data farm other than land use licensing. And in this case also, we're having probably a few hundred equivalents of data farms coming on in a very, very short period. So there is a concern about the amount of power we're putting onto the, we're taking from the grid at one time.
Thank you. Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Thank you very much for the presentation. This is the reason why I very much appreciate the inclusion of the task force in the bill. To me, these numbers are staggering. I mean, the implications of that sort of energy use to me is truly something I think we need to be very, very careful about as we enter into it. So thank you, both co-chairs, for including that in the bill.
Thank you. Thanks for doing this work. I think this is tremendous and interesting, and the task force and the work that you're proposing that is in the bill draft, I think, is going to be really important. I'm excited about that. Is the presentation that you just made on OLIS so that we can refer back to it?
It is.
Wonderful. Thank
just
you.
Just looking at it.
All right. Any other comments on this? Thank you so much.
Thank you.
So I know that we have the director of OLCC, Mr. Marks, and Jesse Peters, who's done tremendous work. Jesse Sweet, who's done tremendous work on this issue. I wanted to invite you, if you would like to make any comments at this point, to come forward and offer your thoughts.
Okay.
That's just they choose to
Chair Lanniger, for the record, Steve Marks, Executive Director of OLCC. As you know, we've had a brief time to look at these, a lot of changes in material here. We have identified a few areas of concern and interest related to OLCC's interest in the bill and not the ad hoc group's interest, although those are intertwined at times. The first is in Section 30. Let me say I appreciate all of the quick work that's gone into pulling all these issues together into the bill and what we have before us in the structure.
Which draft are we on, the nine?
Nines. Draft nine. In the nines on page 37, it's section 30 sub C. This is the issue where we tried to deal with primary residence. And it actually conflicts what we do somewhat in the definition on page 6, line 18 of the definition of licensed premises, where what we were really trying to achieve here is to segment out the licensed premises in an operational plan that we would inspect. As written, the language on page 37, section 30C, really says that we can't inspect that primary residence, that we can't do it as a part of our oversight. So that means essentially that we're put in the position of not licensing an applicant who wanted to include part of their primary residence in their operational area, if they chose to do that. The alternative, which was discussed at some length, I think the committee members heard it, was the issue of, well, if we had a designated sort of operational area that we would generally inspect, what would be our cause to look at a primary residence if, you know, we saw something that was of some standard, and we talked about the standard of reasonable suspicion, to be able to cause an inspector to have the opportunity to look in the house for compliance. How do we be accountable if there's something going
so
forward there?
That's a great point. Our intention is to allow, under appropriate circumstances, those inspections. So since we're all just receiving this, it's possible that the caveat is placed in here somewhere. We haven't discerned it yet, but thank you for that.
It may be a drafting error with the inclusion of an or in that line, 18 or 19.
Right. We'll follow up on that. But
yeah.
I think our intentions are aligned to safeguard primary residences, but under appropriate circumstances, there would be an opportunity to deal with those if there were some kind of cause to believe that wrongdoing was happening. So I'll check in with Mark Mayer.
Chair, just wanted, because of the length of discussion around it, to point that out, because it's an important matter.
Madam Co-Chair, since we're on
sir.
This. So we needed this reference, as Mark said, or Steve said. You got page 6, line 18 through 21 is the definition of premises. When we talked over on Friday, I had the impression that we were going to put a period after the word residence and drop the rest. I understand that OLCC wants to have the ability to go in if they think there's something going on. I think the question for us is reasonable suspicion going to be a high enough threshold for them to go into a primary private residence as compared to going to court to get a warrant to enter someone's house?
So the caveat language is on page 6, line 19, and your question is whether reasonably suspects is the appropriate predicate.
Or probable cause.
I think that the page 6, line 19, does address the point that you raised on page 37. Jesse, yeah, Mr. Sweet,
for,
I'm sorry.
For the record, Jesse Sweet with the OLCC. To speak to Senator Przanski's point here, the OLCC typically does not require, when we deal with liquor licenses, the records to be kept on the premises. So when we're talking about operating the business in the residence, what the OLCC's intention would be to look for production, processing, and sale rather than bookkeeping and things of that nature.
I agree with that assessment, but I think we still have the threshold of when do you get to go into that area to look for those three things.
So, and are you suggesting that the language be reasonably suspects production, processing, or sale as the way to narrow it? And does that seem satisfactory to you, or would you like to have a conversation?
I think we should offline have more conversation.
Okay, but great. Thanks. We've got that noted. All right. You maybe have four other things?
Yeah. Regarding sort of the provisions or the interests you were just speaking about whether medical product, how and when it comes into the recreational system, as we were dealing with the opt-in language there on Section 116, page 83, line 19, There's the ability right now that section references medical product coming into the recreational system, but it only refers to it as medical product. And we think that if you incorporated a may into that language and referenced our recreational system, that then OLCC could develop rules to properly channel medical upward or excess perhaps to the recreational side, depending on what people's proclivity was in doing that through rulemaking. But that would give us the discretion not to be stuck with purely dealing with it as medical product all the way through and all the way up and with the excess, even though that was a lot of the intention as we worked through with the ad hoc committee.
Would you mind repeating the reference point?
It's page 83 in section 116, so it's line 19. And it reads, 18 reads, it's 18. Marijuana plants permitted pursuant to ORS and are identified as marijuana plants that are to be used for the purposes set forth in ORS that references medical. So instead of providing that are to be used, that instead we may have a may and reference OLCC as well, so that we can make some rules and determinations on how that product coming in would be used, usable in the recreational system.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
So is your intent to have the medical, the people who opt into your system with the option to sell their excess into the recreational system, is it your understanding that they will send their medical product through the, even though they're seed to sale, that they'll send their medical product through the medical-only dispensaries? Or how does that work?
So let me reference the ad hoc group's work and then think that under the dash nines that scheme is possible. I think that we saw medical product coming in being tracked all the way up as medical product when identified. There was a conversation about excess product and whether that might be sellable, the excess, into the recreational side of the recreational system. So that wouldn't be just designated. So within our tracking system, we could actually account when it came over. And in the last iterations of our work in the ad hoc group, it was going to be two tracks, medical accounted for all the way through the system. But I guess it would have to have an option if they wanted to put the excess into the recreational side, given this language. If your intention is to ensure that we only put it in the medical track through our system and that that's available, then the language as it exists is fine.
Okay.
Madam Chair, can I just...
Yes, please.
I don't mean to be so slow, but what is this... How do you envision this dispensary? Somebody who opts in and they have medical product and recreational product, and you have two dispensaries on Barber Boulevard. One's a recreational and one's a medical. Where does the medical product from these people who have opted in, where does it go? Does it go to the medical dispensary or does it go to the recreational?
So you want to answer last? So it certainly goes directly in the negotiations to our medical side of the recreational system. There was a discussion. There was a discussion, right, about the opportunity to take that medical product and also sell it to dispensaries. That was that cross arrow on the charts. I'm not sure how this draft has dealt with that piece of it. And Jesse may know.
For the record, Jesse Sweet. Chair Burdick, I'm not sure that I can answer your question with much specificity in terms of the drafting. We've been digesting it as quickly as we can. As I understood the original intention of the opt-in, as it was discussed, I believe the intention was when a medical grower opted in, that medical grower would have the option of selling their medical product either through a medical dispensary established under 3460 or through a retail dispensary established under Measure 91. And that's the kind of the essential element of the opting in. So it would be at the grower's choice and with permission of the cardholder.
But it would be even the stuff that they sold to the medical-only dispensaries would still be full seed-to-sale tract if they wanted that option to sell recreationally. And then the recreational facility, the recreational dispensary, how did you envision that in terms of when cardholders come in? Did you envision them doing as Senator Prezanski said, and they pay the tax because it's a recreational facility, and if they don't want to pay the tax, they go to a medical only. How did you envision that?
Madam Chair, Steve Marks. So the ad hoc group envisioned, I wouldn't say this was uniquely OLCC's viewpoint, right, that medical products, medical cardholders would be tax-free within the recreational system for medical products that carried, and then it had a fairly elaborate determination if there wasn't a medical product that was suitably available, as determined by the owner, then they could buy tax-free a comparable recreational product, but their card would entitle them to not pay the tax.
Okay. Senator Prezanski, you had a comment. And then Senator Cruz, did you have a hand up?
I'm thinking about it.
Okay.
All right. So I thought part of this opt-in was to allow for the grower to come in and actually be under more scrutiny with seed to sell. And that would potentially, I guess, allow them to maybe even grow more plants than they could under the medical program, because now everything's being tracked and accounted for, which would then allow them, based on going through the seed to sell, to have that option to sell into the recreational, because they, for all intent purposes, are a recreational grower. They're just focusing on medical product. Is that
Chair Leininger, Senator Prezanski, I think that's essentially true. Remember that we were dealing with a number of the industry that was committed to medical only or primarily, and assuming that they would be under the plant limit counts, and remembering that we had an extensive land use lux issue in here that would essentially provide a grace period for compliance, we thought that we would have folks that may want to sell into the market their excess that they stored on site until they brought it in and determined what their patients needed, because we would track to the patient number under that proposal, that they might avail themselves of the recreational side of sales under that circumstances. And we would never license, because of the lux issues, if for some issue that was in question, we would never provide an expansion to the pure recreational limits. However, if they met the land use requirements, everything you said fits there. They would be able to expand above and beyond the limits in the medical legislation, medical side of the legislation.
So I'll tell you my understanding. Do you have a question? Yeah, please.
Yeah, just to clear on top of that, but they're the thank you, Madam Co-Chair. They would still, if they're growing for the medical and they're licensed under OHA as a grower for the medical marijuana program, their first responsibility would be to make sure their patients did receive the medical marijuana from the grower. After that, the excess from the patient's marijuana could go to a dispensary or to the recreational side, if this is true. But now you're saying they could also say, well, I'm growing my 48 plants for the medical marijuana program. I can now also have a 5,000-foot recreational license? Is that what I'm hearing you say?
True, that's what you heard me say, and it's because we'd be able to track the plants into the system from that basis.
So that, thank you for that input. You know, my understanding was that the opt-in retained people's plant limits under their medical restriction, and that they could sell excess either to dispensaries, which they already could do, or they could sell excess to rec stores if they chose to go to the seed-to-sale tracking system. And my understanding was actually that they could provide to medical distribution within the OLCC license system. I didn't think it was an omnivorous. You can do both sides of that. So that is helpful. It would be, I think your comments are making me conclude that it would be useful for you to give us some written comments that briefly summarize your position on these issues. But if you want to kind of quickly walk through the three remaining points that you wanted to raise, that would be helpful. And then we will have a chance to reflect on your thoughts.
Madam Chair, Co-Chair, before we get off the section 116, which is the opt-in, I did not see anything in here, so I'd also like to have their comments. We asked last time as to how they can opt out. In other words, a grower who opts in, who decides, this isn't what I want to go back to just medical. They should have some type of pathway for them to do that.
Okay. It could be that that's in here and we can't see it, because I know we directed Mr. Mayor to include that. So,
Madam Chair, if I may, Senator Przanski,
sure.
We believe that they would simply not pursue our commercial recreational license, and that would essentially affect their opt-out at a future date.
Okay. So if you had a couple more points that you wanted to note, we would welcome that.
And Chair, I think the rest of us fall into comments, very small, more technical items, but I think those are some primary issues. And I just want to be clear, because I've been representing OLCC's interest intertwined with the discussions we've had with a broader interest. So I want to be clear that we have a couple things that we're concerned about here within the Dash 9s as OLCC. The other issues are broader than us, and I want to be clear on that.
Okay. Thank you. We appreciate
you.
That.
Madam Chair?
Yes, sir.
I have a question.
Yes.
Is it contemplated that there will be a rule prohibiting minors on premises where growing, processing, and sale occur?
Madam Chair, Senator Ferrioli, the answer to that is yes, it's contemplated there will be a rule. How it is handled, I think, is the question. And we never, or to my recollection, and Jesse, you may help me, we never resolved that, but we understood there would be family members maybe involved with some of these, and that we had to figure out how to take care of that issue as we promulgated rules. And I think mainly part of the larger interest is what happens with other minors who may be friends of the family who are on site, and how do you handle that as well. So, yes, we do contemplate rules for that, but we contemplate rules that would provide for a sensible accommodation of the people that are doing this in the places that they're doing it.
Madam Chair, I'd be very interested in exploring the question, what sensible means, you know, what are reasonable regulations. In looking at parallels with Oregon liquor control licensees for restaurants, you got children as consumers you probably have minors as workers. And, you know, there's time, place, and manner restrictions, and there's, you know, other reasonable rules that apply. That's not true of distilleries. You know, places where things are manufactured and processed, you don't generally have minors present anywhere on the premises. So, you know, I think in this prosaic sort of craft grower environment that I have been thinking about, if you do have the family farm where the residence is used for part of the processing, packaging operation, not necessarily records keeping, that's not an issue. You might likely have children present. And so the question is, half the world, all of the folks at this dais are mandatory reporters, as every state employee is. And so we've got a sort of culture clash a-brewing here between the vision of a family operation on a family farm where children are present, where products are grown, processed, packaged, and possibly even sold. It's a thorny issue, Madam Chair. I don't think we've had a discussion of any legislative intent, you know, where we intend people to land on the issue. Because right now, the conflicts are really clear. And I don't know that we've had any kind of conversation with the regulatory agencies who are concerned with child welfare. I know I haven't asked them, how would you feel about encountering a situation where the family business is marijuana production, children are present, and these are not public places, so consumption occurs, you know. And you know, I think we've finessed the issue of children who are medical marijuana cardholders. You know, that issue I feel comfortable with, it's resolved. But the rest of it, I think, is going to be a rulemaking thicket for either OHA or OLCC. So I would like to hear some discussion about how the time, place, and manner issues for processing, growing, and premise licenses where a home might be involved. Now, I'm not worried about a commercial operation. I think that those are analogous to a distillery. You know, I wouldn't imagine that your employees in that indoor grow operation would be children. I imagine they would be adults. But I'm more concerned about whether or not the complexities of having the family farm involved or family scale architecture or agriculture is the objective. Mm-hmm. What you do on our obligation to protect children, which I know everybody takes seriously.
Right.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Just raising a question.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I mean, I could envision some kind of legislative intent being provided that directs OLCC or that directs the rulemaking agencies to develop rules that are appropriate to, in light of the fact that some of the producing operations happen on family farms, but that we have an interest in making sure that children are protected from exposure to intoxicants. You know, something like that just says it's a thing, go forth and make good policy or rules, our OLCC.
Well, Madam Chair, I think if I can continue just
Please.
That much further. If that means that the OLCC cannot license an operation which uses part of a residence for primary processing, then the obligation for the grower would be build a shed. You know, take the primary processing out of the home. And that might resolve the issue, both issues of inspections in the home, probable cause versus reasonable suspicion, you know, and make it a license condition that none of the processing would happen in a home, particularly where there are children. But I'm not going to write the rule. I'm just going to raise the question.
Thank you. Good points. Okay, any follow-up comments on that? All right, thank you. Thanks for coming up, gentlemen. Because this is a work session, it's not a public hearing, we do not have a sign-up list or remaining public comment. We are now at a place where we have three different amendments and two different bills that reflect essentially an integrated package of approach that we've all been working on for a really long time. Over the next little bit, we're going to be looking at closely at the language that we got from Mr. Mayor to make sure that it reflects our intentions, answering any questions that may emerge as we look at the language provided, and hopefully move toward a point where we can work the bills in short order. So does anyone have any follow-up thoughts within that framework? Yes, sir.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Colleagues, I have a little bit of concern from the issue raised tonight. We spent a long time talking about the sizes of grow sites in terms of the medical side of it, and now if it does seem like it's possible for someone to opt in as a medical grower and then simply expand their operations through a dual OLCC license, that's not something I had thought that the direction we're heading in, it might lead us to the consequence of having extremely large grows when we hadn't really intended that consequence. So I'm not sure what the solution to that is, but I think at least I want to voice my concern. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair.
Yes,
I share that same concern. And I don't think we were ever talking about dual licenses. Mm-hmm. I think we were talking about one license. But
right. This
idea of having someone be a medical grower with cardholders dependent on them and then being able to expand their operation in a, I thought it was really intended for the excess because the grow limits are very generous and there will be excess. And I thought that was the intention.
That is absolutely my understanding, too. So would it address the concern that you articulated, Representative Buckley and Senator Burdick, if in fact we move forward with the idea that, you know, plant limits that are identified in what has been Senate Bill 964 apply if you're a medical grower, if after satisfying your duties to your medical patient and making any sales to a dispensary, the medical dispensary you choose to make, you decide that you want to opt in to have eligibility to sell to the rec market your remaining excess. If that's how we interpreted it, then that's what I always thought we were doing, and that's a nice bright line. We could seek legislative clarification to make sure that that's what's reflected in the statute. Yes, sir, Senator Cruz.
There's a lot of stuff I want to talk offline. I'm not sure about an opt-in. I think a sell-in would. Well, quite simply, you know, I mean, if you're a medical grower, you're a medical grower. You don't have to opt in to anything, but you have an avenue to sell your product into the recreational side rather than an opt-in to the OLCC system.
So the difference is, if I can respond, as far as I understand it, the opt-in would be opting into the seed-to-sale reporting system.
For that portion, but not your whole program, just your excess that you're selling into the recreational market.
I think that the intent is to opt in your entire operation.
Yeah. You'd have to.
And Senator Brzezinski.
Yeah, I think you'd have to actually, you know, truly opt in to have the seed to sell work. But
Senator Cruz and I have talked about this. Maybe, and I think the point that he's trying to make is, maybe with the reporting light that we have on the OHA side, everything's going to still be accounted for as to the quantity and all that. And they should have to be able to justify and show that whatever they have in excess lines up with what has already been given to the patient, what has already been given permission by the patient to go to a dispensary, and whatever's left over, there still should be a check and balance there. And that is what I'm thinking Senator Cruz is saying. With that amount, then you could actually bring it over because there's still the accountability.
through the...
But with the tracking system, with the full tracking.
Yeah, once it goes into that system, it would then go under their tracking system. But it wouldn't be on the front part because either you're already in the seed-to-sell opt-in or you're in the OHA. So, I mean, there's two different things here.
Madam Chair, I thought the whole point of it was if you're in the OHA tracking light, then you only have access to your own patients and to the medical dispensaries.
That's right.
And if you want the option to sell your excess into the recreational, then from the get-go, you have to have all your product with the fuller tracking. Is that what you were saying?
Well, I think that would be a way to do it. That's one of the models, but what I thought I heard Senator Cruz was saying, maybe with whatever the excess was from the OHA system, there should be a path for that to be able to come into the recreational side.
So I'm going to jump in. It's a challenging spot we're in because there are so many moving pieces here. What I think we had decided, and it's not as maybe desirable from the perspective of an OHA medical grower as what you're describing now, Senator Prezzonsi, but what I felt like we had coalesced around is what Senator Burdick is noting, that, you know, if you want to be a medical grower, and you don't want access to a rec store market, then you have tracking light, you have your plant caps, and you may sell your access beyond patients to medical dispensaries. If you choose to think it's a good idea to access rec system for access beyond the patient access and the dispensary access, you could choose to do full-on OLCC tracking from moment one onward. That might not be that good a deal. It might be that it's so rigorous that it's not that attractive, but it is a clean, bright line, and that's what I think we had agreed to before. I would say that we've got so many moving parts and we're so late in the day on where we are. I'd be inclined to stick with where I think we ended up, and we can always adjust it in future legislative sessions. Where I think we ended up over the last few weeks was what I just described. How do people feel about sticking with that for the time being?
I'm fine with that.
Okay, I think we're going to, Representative Olson.
I think we're just going to have to be really cautious here where we're going, because I don't want to open up the door to the black market.
Yes.
I mean, I don't think any of us in here do. Yeah. But right now, I mean, with this kind of discussion, it bothers me. I think Representative Buckley hit it on the head. So.
Okay. Well, I think you're right. And hopefully by staying with what we had been talking about last week, that helps address concerns about moving targets at the last minute. So, Senator Prezzonsi, and then if we're done with conversation, I'll close the hearing.
So I think I'd want to call out, looking at the draft, this is the dash nines, page 20, and it starts at line 5. It's basically talking about the tier system, and this is for producers. And when I read through this, it makes me think that we potentially would have a tier system for future size of grow operations. And then there's in line 14 talks about OLCC taking into consideration the market demand for items in the state. So I'm very concerned as to, and want us to be cautious about, what are we really wanting to do here, because I could see where we could potentially be setting up for litigation depending on how you allow for people to get their grow operations running. And then are we going to say, after they've been under a license for a year, when they come up to renew, for whatever reason, we're going to tell you can't grow as much as you did previously, or are we going to allow for people to increase their grow? And so one of the cautions might be, knowing all this is going to be done by rule, maybe this legislature wants to actually put some type of limit on the actual size of the grow operation if you're going to do the tier thing, so we know what that cap is, because of, you know, multiple things that have come up with Representative Buckley says about energy, etc. But at the same time, I'm not sure how this portion really fits into someone getting a license in the recreational side and just starting to grow. And one of the things that we're concerned about, having 100 square foot warehouses being used, as we've seen in other states, then there seems to me that we need to give some type of parameters for the agency to build their rules around.
Madam Chair, if I could respond to that. We've obviously talked about this a lot. I think the intent was to set up the sideboards and expect a number from OLCC, expect an upward number so people would know. The problem with putting a number in statute is it's there in statute, and you have to change the statute in order to adjust the number. So I guess what I would like to see us do is to get the kind of sideboards and the kind of direction we want for OLCC to consider, and then say, yes, go ahead and set a number. It probably makes sense to have a number to provide clarity, but not in statute.
Representative Buckley.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. This is the effort we've been making on the energy issue, trying to bring forward the idea that actually energy consumption should be a sideboard to this industry as we build it forward. And I do respect Senator Byer's remark about the idea that people want data centers in their community for the jobs. I do understand that. But we are talking about a very high consumption industry that unless we put sidebars on, there will be consequences. We jumped forward. We proposed an energy plan that we thought would be effective for actually using energy use as a way to limit the size of a grow. Strategically do that in that tiered system that Senator Brzezinski was talking about to make sure that there was any energy consumption plan. I know that's a difficult leap to make, which is why we're back on the task force effort, but I do think it's essential for us to think through the possible sideboards we're suggesting to OLCC. As Senator Brzezinski mentioned, we could find ourselves in a situation where we've granted 120 licenses and we haven't put restrictions on the size of any kind. We have very large grows that are having impact on energy consumption or water use, et cetera, or environmental impact. And then how do you pull back after that? Mm-hmm. How do you pull back and say either no more grows in the state, or how do you pull back someone's ability to do their business as they've set it up? I'm just not sure how you go down that road.
Thank you. I think that's a good point. I'll tell you what I thought the legislative intent behind this was, and it does make an effort to get to points that the two of you have made. My understanding of the legislative intent was that we would ask OLCC, taking into account the demands, the market demand in the state for recreational sales of marijuana, to establish maximum canopy sizes, because we didn't feel like we were quite in a good position at this moment to pick a number and enshrine it for a long time in statute, and then create a tiered system that enables people to graduate up, not up and back, but graduate up, taking into account the ceiling, the maximum canopy size, and also the demand for more production. So we were trying to get at not having excessive amounts of production and not having backseas so that people have really unpredictable opportunity to grow. But we didn't want to make all those decisions in this body because rulemaking would give you more chance to talk out what makes sense. Did that accurately capture your understanding?
That very accurately
Thank
captured
you. It. Senator Farioli and then Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm struck with a circular logic. And here is, if I can just get off this merry-go-round for a second.
No, you're stuck.
Yeah, till July 11th.
Yeah, could be.
We're currently producing a lot more marijuana than is consumed in Oregon. We're using current water supplies and current energy production. And if all of the marijuana production in Oregon stayed in Oregon, we would be able to meet the current demand multiple times over, three to five times over, if we can believe the estimates that have been given to the committee just on the medical side. The problem we're having is we don't know what the size of the grow is in the state of Oregon currently, and we have no really accurate modeling for the size of the available market. We have a lot of entrepreneurial energy, way more entrepreneurial energy than we need to meet all the foreseeable demand if you go on the four corners doctrine of meeting the demand within the state. What we're not acknowledging is that the folks moving into Oregon to invest in production facilities here anticipate a national market.
That's true.
So now we are thinking small ball,
yeah.
Local grows, branding, the kind of Mayberry model of marijuana grows.
Yes.
And the folks that I've been meeting in my office are multinational entrepreneurs who are willing to plunge cardboard boxes full of $100 bills into the industry here. And what we're trying to build is a manageable system for Opie and Andy to manage. And it's just going to blow by our capacity unless we acknowledge that what's really going to happen here is that because of the expertise and the cluster this industry has created in Oregon, the synergies that are here, but we're not applying the same economic model that we've used for high technology and aerospace and other things that we've been chasing. This is going to be here because this cluster's grown up in spite of us. So I'm concerned that what we're doing is building in such constraints at the front end that we're going to have to rewrite this thing every year from here to forever. But what I would urge us to do is to realize that the folks that are going to invest in this program are not investing to produce enough to meet the demand in Oregon. We're doing that multiple times over now. And we're doing it without distorting energy rates or using too much water. The question is the scale up and how far up does the scale go? I think the scale up is going to be a lot bigger than we think it is. So I guess the conclusion to this getting off the merry-go-round is we're writing this program as if it were going to be a local program for Oregon only, and I think the folks that want to invest in this business anticipate a much broader marketing, regional if not national, and maybe international.
Well, I think that's true, and I'm going to go to Senator Beyer and then Senator Cruz. But I think a crucial point that you made is that we are going to have to redo this statute every year for the next number of years, and I think we shouldn't.
Mark Mayer is now hanging from a light pole in the bathroom.
Oh. That's really something. So, but what I would say though is we shouldn't feel like the only success in this iteration of passing these bills is to have anticipated every single thing that's going to happen between now and 50 years from now. I mean, I think we have to start somewhere. We have to deal with the best information and the values of our community at this time, knowing what we know at this time, and knowing that no matter what, we're going to keep evolving it and we're going to keep addressing new information. So, I would say in that framework that we need to clarify some pieces of our shared understanding in this draft, but I think that we've come really far and we have a really good product for the information that we have at this moment in the life of the industry, and of course we're going to change it over time and with new information, but that doesn't mean we don't need to pass something now that's as good as we can do at this time. So,
well, and also, Madam Chair, in recognition of the fact that it's just flat out illegal to send it across our borders right now. And I think the people who are coming in are anticipating a time when this will be descheduled at the federal level and we'll be able to actually have a national industry.
Yeah.
But that's a risk. But right now, that's we have to deal with reality, and that is we have to have an industry that we can credibly tell the federal government this is Oregon only. We have to do that, otherwise we're at risk.
But it is a fascinating and tantalizing puzzle we're working with. Senator Cruz and Senator Beyer.
A couple things. Number one, I'm not sure that the Open Andy reference was appropriate for this committee, but I'll let that go for now, because Mayberry is a very special place in my heart. So I can remember what life was like back then. just an issue on the greenhouses. Let's not get too hung up just on size, because it's a type of operation as well. You can run some low-tech things and get good products. Yeah. So we need to be kind of cognizant that there are other factors that go into that. Senator Burdick, you're right. There's anticipation that the feds will do something at some point in time. We've been saying that for how many decades now?
Why are you looking at me, Senator?
Okay. but indeed, that will happen. For our current iteration, what we're doing now is for Oregon and Oregon only, and it's an Oregon industry. We want it to be an Oregon industry. I don't want to see massive 100,000-acre pot farms.
Yeah.
Actually, I only have 700 acres, so that wouldn't fit either. But I also don't want to have a whole lot of restrictions because the Senator Representative Olson talked about taking the black market out of this. You know, it would probably be nice that we had so much pot that the price went down. What a concept. Okay.
Great. Thank you. Senator Beyer?
Well, I think the key is not all of these arbitrary restrictions, but the seed to sale, tracking what's there. If we do that, we know what's produced and what's sold, then let the market regulate it. Mm-hmm. The market does a good job with products, and just leave it alone.
Good. All right. Thank you. And we do have that seed to sale in there. Any Representative Olson, any wisdom as we close the meeting?
It's 11 minutes till. I think it's time for us to leave.
Okay.
That's wise.
All right, then. With that, I'll say we'll close the work session and adjourn the meeting. Thank you.
Thank you.
Adjourn the meeting. Thank you.
Thank you.